hours was over, every Moses contention subject to factual analysis had been utterly demolished. And as for the side of the controversy not subject to mathematical analysis, the aesthetic side, the effect of the bridge on the beauty of Battery Park and New York Harbor, the old reformers felt the demolition job had been even more devastating. There was a pounding of canes on the council chamber's oaken floor and a chorus of "Hear, hear!" out of another age when George McCanany said of Moses' proposal, "What all this would do to the values of real estate, some of it the most valuable in the world, I leave to others." But that the city would permit its famous battery to be dealt with in such fashion seems to me an incredible thing. I am, in fact, of the opinion that if the plans under discussion are seriously pressed, there will be an uprising of public opinion the like of which has not been known since, 40 years ago, some well-intentioned gentleman in office proposed that City Hall be torn down to make way for something more modern in the skyscraping line. Wrinkled, stooped old McCanany had lost none of his eloquence, and when he had finished summing up the reformers' arguments and pointed out to the council that all they were requesting was a study by impartial experts appointed by the council itself to determine the true facts in the case, to study the various alternatives and determine which one would really be best for the city, it was difficult for the reformers, wise though they were in the ways of politicians, to believe that the request would not be granted. And then, in the seventh hour of the hearing, Robert Moses stood up to speak. Reading from a yellow legal pad, on which he had been scribbling furiously during the opposition speeches, he turned his attention first to the analysis of the relative efficiency of civil service architects and private consultants. "I want to warn my friends in the civil service that civil service can become a racket," he said. "It's getting to be so that nothing will please them but a communist state, which we know is so pleasing to Mr. Isaacs." There was a moment of shocked silence in the council chamber. Then came a storm of boos and hisses, which Moses' lieutenants tried ineffectually to drown out with cheers and applause. But Moses was not to be deterred by boos. He directed his next remarks to the Regional Plan Association proposal. "The RPA had always opposed progress," he said. "It had sided with the fox hunters and estate owners to oppose the Northern State Parkway, Heckscher State Park, and Jones Beach, and many of his other Long Island projects. In New York City, RPA planners were in a dither about the Henry Hudson Bridge. They asked delay and advocated a low-level bridge. They said the Henry Hudson Bridge would ruin the finest spot in Manhattan. We built the bridge, and a week after it opened, the bankers confessed that they had been wrong. We said it would average 16,000 cars, they said 6,000, and we were right. The RPA has been wrong about all these things," he said, "and therefore, why should we suppose that it is right about this one? Its current proposal is, in fact, nonsense. Every argument applicable to the Battery Bridge is applicable tenfold against the Brooklyn Bridge." The reformers sat, hardly believing what they were hearing. Although the RPA had opposed the Northern State Parkway, it was just not true that the RPA had opposed Heckscher State Park and Jones Beach. It had supported them, as it had supported almost all Moses' Long Island projects. Moreover, the Parkway fight had taken place 15 years before. What did it have to do with a discussion about the Battery Crossing? The RPA had thought the Henry Hudson Bridge would ruin the finest spot in Manhattan, and the bridge had ruined the finest spot in Manhattan. The bridge might be a success in financial terms, but it was a failure in any other terms. The heavy traffic and the resultant congestion proved that, not disproved it. How could every argument applicable to the Battery Bridge be applicable to the Brooklyn Bridge, when the whole point was that the Brooklyn Bridge already existed, and therefore could be rebuilt cheaply and without further destroying real estate values or the harbor view? And then Moses turned his attention to the RPA's president. Only a man who wasn't going to run for public office would propose slapping a toll on the Brooklyn Bridge, Moses said. No man in his right mind would do that. It was, he said, all right for Mr. McEnany to make such a proposal. He's not going to run for public office again. He turned and glanced at the wrinkled old man sitting behind him. He's an extinct volcano, Moses said. He's an exhumed mummy. This time there were neither boos nor cheers in the council chamber. There was only silence, unbroken until Moses began to speak again. If there was an argument raised that he answered directly, I don't remember it, says one of the reformers present that day. We had raised a lot of issues. He hardly mentioned them. All he did was lash out at individuals, at respected, public-spirited men, with a spitefulness, a viciousness, that was almost unbelievable to see. There was no attempt to meet the RPA proposal logically. It was simply nonsense, Moses said, or to discuss the effect of a gigantic suspension bridge on the view of the harbor. The most beautiful architecture wrought by man is a bridge, especially a suspension bridge. And the finest view in Manhattan is the view you get walking across the Triborough Bridge to the Bronx or Queens, he said. And that, apparently, was all that had to be said on that point. As for the argument that the bridge would ruin Battery Park, the park was no beauty spot anyway, he said. If McEnany was so interested in it, why hadn't he done something for it when he was in office? Those arguments that he did answer, he answered with lies. The proposal that the Tunnel Authority build the crossing? Moses said that the Tunnel Authority had built the Queens Midtown Tunnel so incompetently that the Tunnel Authority will be busted when it is finished. Washington knows that, and I know it. The city was going to have to step in and rescue the tunnel. The Tunnel Authority was actually bringing in the tunnel far under cost. When it was finished, the authority would, far from being busted, have a surplus of more than $4 million. And Moses, who had been doing detailed analyses of its financing, must have known this. The need for a city contribution for the West Side Highway and East River Drive extensions? Colossal effrontery! The Citizens Budget Commission fellow's figures are just beyond me. I don't know where he got them. But Moses must have known precisely where he had gotten them. The key arguments Moses didn't answer at all. He gave no explanation of where he obtained the disputed figures for the tunnel, and as for the bridge, all he would say was, I have built many bridges, both over water and over land, and I know what the costs are. We are letting contracts every day for the same kind of work, and when we give you an estimate, it is accurate and our reputation is behind it. The councilman could take his figures or leave them, he seemed to say. The councilman, and the city they represented, could take or leave his whole proposal, he made clear. When one ventured to ask him why he objected to a delay to give time for the alternatives to be studied, he put it to them straight. This is a showdown project. Either you want it or you don't want it, and either you want it now or you don't get it at all. He was giving the city an ultimatum. The city could either take his proposal or leave it. He wasn't going to waste his time discussing it. And the councilman took it. Without leaving the council chamber, hastily putting their heads together, the men who had been contacted the night before by LaGuardia or by Steingut or by Cruz voted unanimously to release the Home Rule message from the committee immediately, without even an hour's study, and to send it to the full council for a vote the following morning. Moses snatched his yellow legal pad off the desk and stalked out of the room, his aides scampering behind him. There was a broad smile on his face. The rest of the audience left the council chamber more slowly. As they filed out, many of them came over to McEnany and touched his shoulder consolingly. Burlingham, hobbling over on a cane, put his arm around him and whispered something in his ear. But consolation was not easy. Years later, Comptroller Joseph D. McGoldrick, explaining why he was afraid of Robert Moses, would tell the author, I was there that day, you know, sitting in the audience, when he said that to George McEnany. Mr. McEnany was old and wrinkled and very shrunken by that time, you know, and when Moses called him an exhumed mummy, I saw the expression on his face. I saw it, you know. so I was afraid of him. Other reformers would later describe their overriding emotion at Moses' philosophy and tactics as shock. They had no justification for such an emotion. There was nothing new about that philosophy or those tactics. The insistence that his proposals be viewed only in isolation, that each be viewed strictly as an attempt to solve a particular, limited problem by creating a particular structure of concrete and steel, that it not be evaluated in terms of the needs of the city as a whole, the need for a bridge, for example, weighed against the need for schools and hospitals, or even as part of a larger problem of which the specific problem was only a part, a traffic-moving machine like a bridge evaluated in terms of the city's overall traffic-moving problem, and especially not in terms of its impact on the surrounding neighborhood, was the same insistence that had underlain the public works he had been building in their city for 5 years. Moses had used these same arguments in arguing for a dozen other projects, most of which the reformers had enthusiastically supported. If they had ever taken a close look at those projects, had ever examined them with the same care with which they examined the Brooklyn Battery Bridge, they would have seen that this philosophy lay behind them. They were shocked now only because they had never bothered to take such a look. As for the vicious personal attacks, Moses had been making vicious personal attacks for years. The only difference was that this time the target was them, and they therefore saw how unfair the attacks were. Previously, they had laughed indulgently at Moses' propensity for personal vituperation, regarding it as a harmless idiosyncrasy. Perhaps, when one took into account all the crooked politicians, hack bureaucrats, and selfish private individuals with whom Moses had to deal, even admirable. In that laughter and that indulgence was a feeling that Moses' methods, however distasteful, however antithetical to their principles, were justified by the difficulties he had to surmount to get things done. But in the Battery Crossing fight, the reformers could not avoid taking a good look at one of Robert Moses' controversies and at Robert Moses. They could no longer avoid seeing precisely what kind of man they had for so long believed in. The Battery Crossing fight was the moment of truth in their relationship with Moses. After supporting him for years in a score of battles, after sacrificing over and over again the principles so dear to them in his support, after helping to raise him to power and helping to keep him in power, they saw him at last for what he was. And they realized that he was not the embodiment of everything they believed in, but its antithesis. If, for the 20 years before the fight, the good government organizations of New York City had supported him, for the 20 years after the fight, those organizations would oppose him. The Battery Crossing fight was also the moment of truth for the reformers in another respect. It made them see that their opposition no longer mattered to Moses. They had played a vital role in his acquisition of power in the city. Quite possibly, in fact, he could not have acquired that power without their help. But he had taken that power and used it to acquire more and more of it. And now, they suddenly realized, he had enough of it so that they could not take it back from him, could not, in fact, stop him from the absolutely untrammeled use of it. He no longer had to be concerned with their opinions, and he wasn't concerned with their opinions. They were the city's aristocracy. They had always had a voice, an important voice, in decisions vital to the city, a voice that was important to them because they cared about and loved the city. But in the areas that Robert Moses had carved out for his own, they would have a voice no longer. And neither would the city. For if the Battle of the Battery Crossing was a moment of truth for the reformers, it was also, although no one recognized it as such, a moment of truth for New York. It was not, of course, only the reformers who opposed Moses' proposal, or at least the haste with which he was trying to ram it through. Also in the opposition were most of the city's most important elected officials, right up to the mayor, and, speaking with a virtually unanimous voice, the city's press. Always before, elected officials, backed by the press, would have possessed more than sufficient power at least to get a few weeks' time to study a proposal if they wanted to study it. But they possessed such power no longer. The city had a problem that desperately needed solution. It had no money to solve the problem itself. Moses had the money. And if the city wanted a solution, it would have to accept his solution or none at all. That was the narrow limit of its choices, which was really no choice at all. The ultimatum that Moses had delivered, first to the mayor and then to the city council, symbolized this reality, and so did the reaction of the mayor and the city council to that ultimatum. Less than 24 hours after the city council meeting hearing, the full council voted 19-6 to endorse the mayor's home rule request to the legislature for passage of the bills that would foreclose any possibility of study. Moses watched the proceeding with what a reporter described as a happy smile. Less than 24 hours after that, with Steingut wielding the bullwhip, the bills were passed, 106-6 by the Assembly, 41-1 by the Senate. "I'm not surprised," Moses told reporters with a smile. And less than 24 hours after that, Governor Lehman announced he would sign the bill. Not because he approved the bridge, he was careful to state, "I have no means of forming a sound judgment on the project," but because it was a city affair, and the city's elected officials had asked him to sign it. When the issue, in the form of a Triborough Authority request for Board of Estimate approval of a contract covering the relative city and authority contributions to the project, a request worded in such a way that Isaacs said it constituted a blank check to Triborough, came before the board, LaGuardia ran the meeting with an iron hand. McGoldrick and Morris, despite their preference for a tunnel, voted for the bridge, and Isaac's two votes were the only ones cast against Moses' project. Only one more step was required before Moses could begin sinking the bridge pilings, War Department approval, and this was regarded as no more than a formality. In fact, Moses had been privately assured by the Army Corps of Engineers that the approval would be forthcoming shortly. "The tunnel is dead," Moses said, and the reformers saw no hope that he was wrong. In A Man for All Seasons, Sir Thomas More warns young Roper about the consequences of letting ends justify means. When the young man says he would cut down every law in England to get after the devil, More replies, "Oh, and when the last law was down and the devil turned round on you, where would you hide, Roper, the laws all being flat?" The reformers could have benefited from More's warning. Robert Moses was, of course, not a devil, but to give Moses power in the city, they had cut down the laws in which they believed. Now those laws no longer existed to protect the city from him. For the reformers in the city they loved, there was no place to hide. There was nothing the city, opposed to the bridge, could do to keep Moses from building it. When the reformers were in deepest trouble, they always seemed to turn to the same man. Now they delegated Paul Windles to go see him. Windles walked over to 27 William Street and into the office of the senior partner of Burlingham, Veter, Clark, and Hupper, and C.C., after thinking for several long minutes, suddenly smiled. "That wonderful smile," Windles would say. "When you saw that smile, you felt everything was going to be all right," and said, "Call Eleanor." In the April 5, 1939 edition of her newspaper column, My Day, Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt was enthusiastically discussing her grandchildren when she switched abruptly to one paragraph on a different topic. "I have a plea from a man who is deeply interested in Manhattan Island, particularly in the beauty of the approach from the ocean at Battery Park. He tells me that a New York official, who is without doubt always efficient, is proposing a bridge 100 feet high at the river, which will go across to the Whitehall building over Battery Park. This, he says, will mean a screen of elevated roadways, pillars, etc., at that particular point. I haven't a question that this will be done in the name of progress, and something undoubtedly needs to be done, but isn't there room for some consideration of the preservation of the few beautiful spots that still remain to us on an overcrowded island?" A single small paragraph on a subject she would not raise again, but revealing nonetheless, as the smallest ripple in a pond's still water reveals the hidden trout below. For that paragraph was the ripple, the only ripple, that revealed that far below the surface of the public controversy over Robert Moses' huge bridge, down in the quiet, murky depths, impenetrable to the public gaze, in which real power lurks, private passions were beginning to roil the water, and Robert Moses' great enemy was beginning to move against him. Ignoring the apparent hopelessness of their cause, the Reformers' Central Committee of Organizations, opposed to Moses Bridge, kept filling letters to the editor columns with phrases out of another age. The best, as always, were Burlingham's. At the risk of being called an extinct firecracker, I venture to say that the planning and art commissions have been faithless servants. What justification can there be for men whom we have trusted to preserve the beauty of New York to destroy or risk the destruction of any feature of that beauty? There must be more public hearings, and Moses must be made to furnish more information for them, for a public hearing without specific detailed figures furnished in advance will only darken counsel. Burlingham's were the only letters Moses answered directly. I see that Mr. Burlingham is back in the papers again. His reference to the depressing effect of bridges on surrounding real property is wholly inaccurate. I am sending Mr. Burlingham some pictures of the Bronx Whitestone Bridge, which most of us think is one of the finest things built by man in New York. It will enormously improve surrounding property. Burlingham, saying, "It is an honor even to be noticed by Mr. Moses," replied, "To compare the effect of the Whitestone Bridge on the vast swampy regions of the Bronx with that of the Brooklyn Battery Bridge on Lower Manhattan seems a little far-fetched. I'd still like to see a breakdown of his final estimates." And Moses hastily broke off the exchange. But it was not written public communications that were to be decisive, but private, and communications too private to be entrusted to writing. Burlingham had told Windles to call Eleanor, and C.C. himself had written to Eleanor's husband. In a letter across whose top the great attorney, then 81 years old, scrawled in longhand, "In graveyard confidence," he wrote, "Dear Franklin, now please stop and read my letter to the Herald Tribune. Nobody fit to have an opinion wants the Battery Bridge except Bob Moses. The War Department can stop it. Verbum sufficio sapienti, especially when the sapient being is a lover of New York, as well as President of the United States and Commander-in-Chief of the Army." The Commander-in-Chief apparently took the hint. The War Department hearing was held under the direction of the Army Corps of Engineers in New York, and Moses was assured by Colonel C.L. Hall, the Chief District Engineer, that a favorable report would be issued shortly. But the day after the hearing, the Colonel's superior, Major General J.L. Schley, Chief of the Army Corps of Engineers, received a note from Presidential Aide Edwin W. Watson, asking him to speak to the President before you make any report on the subject. The report was not issued as scheduled, and when Moses asked when it would be, the engineers were suddenly evasive. And Secretary of War Harry H. Woodring suddenly began to take a personal interest in New York Harbor. Ickes brought up the bridge in a cabinet meeting one day, saying that he recommended its construction. Francis Perkins recalled what happened then. The President pulled down his lip, a sign by which I always knew that something phony was going on inside of him. He'd pull his mouth down over his teeth and say, "Oh, yes," or "Oh, no," as the case might be. It was a curious facial expression. He said, "Well, I don't know. I want to think about that and look into it, Harold." Some weeks later, the Secretary of the Interior, who hadn't known the President as long as had the Secretary of Labor, brought up the bridge again and, in Miss Perkins' words, was insistent about its being approved. According to Miss Perkins, the President said, "Well, we'll have to consult the military. That's a very important channel." Ickes said, "That's all right, Mr. President. We figured out everything. It will not interfere with the operation of ships." but all the president would say was, "Well, I'd like to think about it." Icky's finally caught on. Miss Perkins relates, "Icky said to me, 'The president is going to kill this. He's going to kill this wonderful project. I wish you'd speak to him. I wish you'd argue it out with him.' I said, 'Well, how is he going to kill it?' 'He's getting the military to condemn it.' I said, 'Are you sure?' 'Yes,' he said. 'I know. I have evidence. He's telling the military to say that it interferes with the navigable streams, and it doesn't, not at all. It's all been thought out. It's just that he so hates that Moses. God knows Moses hates him, but I should think that we could build a bridge without regard to that.'" Miss Perkins did speak to the president, who, she says, replied, "Well, it's no good, Francis. It's just a no good idea." Listing the reformer's objections to the bridge, he added, "Besides, I am reliably informed that though the engineers haven't finished with this, they think it's a very great hazard to navigation. In case of war, we can't have any bridges around there. They'll drop bombs and so forth." I came back and told Harold that I guessed he was right. The president was not going to do it, Miss Perkins recalled. There was nothing more I could do. There were plenty of other public works projects that were available and didn't have Moses' name on them. On May 18, 1939, Watson sent the president a memo, which the presidential staff filed in the personal and confidential file, stating that, "The Secretary of War phoned me this morning to please let you know that the War Department has rejected the proposition to build a bridge from the Battery to Brooklyn. He wanted you to have this confidential information, as it has not yet been announced to the public." The confidential information was not announced to the public, or to Moses, or even to LaGuardia, for 2 more months. So tight was the lid of secrecy clamped down that Moses, usually so astute, feeling the only reason for the delay was bureaucratic red tape, did not for some weeks realize what was happening, kept his engineers drawing plans for the bridge, and, until suspicion began to dawn, spent the 2 months firing off angry telegrams to the Corps of Engineers, demanding a decision on the request for a permit, convinced that the decision could only be favorable. It was not until July 17, 1939, that Secretary of War Woodring announced in Washington that he had decided not to approve the project because "the proposed bridge is seaward of a vital naval establishment, the U.S. Navy Yard at Brooklyn, and if knocked down during a war, might block access to the yard from the sea." The Herald Tribune reported that Moses reacted to the decision with rage and ridicule, and both reactions were understandable. There were already 2 other bridges, the Brooklyn and Manhattan spans, seaward of the Brooklyn Navy Yard, and other bridges seaward of other naval institutions all over the United States. The only way a suspension bridge could be knocked down, moreover, would be by hitting one of a handful of key cables. If a bomb hit the bridge span itself, it would go right through. And Air Force experts queried by Moses prior to the decision had estimated the chances of this happening at 100,000 to 1. Attempting to repeat his 1935 strategy of bringing Roosevelt's behind-the-scenes maneuvering into the open, Moses issued a statement hinting that the president was behind the decision. When reporters failed to catch the hint, Moses made it broader at another press conference, reminding reporters that Ickes had taken the blame for the 1935 ouster attempt and saying, "Why don't you fellows find out if the Secretary of War is willing to take the blame for this?" But Roosevelt had learned from the 1935 controversy. Then, during a press conference, he had incautiously allowed himself to be identified with Icky's decision. Now, when, at another press conference, reporters questioned him about the Woodring decision, the president said firmly that the decision had been that of Woodring and the War Department alone. Pressed to say whether or not he agreed with the decision, he said he had no opinion on it at all. Try as Moses would to link him with it, he could not do so. The fox had left no tracks. And he had planned more cleverly than he had in 1935, as Moses admitted in a formal statement brimming with frustration. No doubt this squares up accounts so far as the Triborough Bridge Authority is concerned. The effort to force the resignation of its chief executive officer failed because the public opinion would not stand for it. In the present case, the procedure has been a great deal shrewder because it is assumed that the average person is in no position to argue with military boards of strategy and must accept their conclusion, no matter how silly. Moses attempted to enlist LaGuardia in an attack on Woodring's decision, but the mayor seemed rather uninterested, and the reason suddenly became clear to Moses when the RFC abruptly decided that it was willing to lend the Tunnel Authority not the $39 million that had previously been its limit, but $59 million, and to make the loan at an interest rate so reduced that the cost of the tunnel, which it now turned out, would in fact have been not Moses' $84 million, but Singstad's $65 million, could be reduced to $59 million. LaGuardia's gratification was intense. "This administration is never daunted by anything," he gloated. "We just go on to the next thing." Moses' rage over what he regarded as his greatest defeat never cooled, not even after the tunnel, years later, was incorporated into his Triborough empire. Any mention of the tunnel, even the most casual reference by a luncheon guest trying to make conversation, would cause the big jaw to jut angrily and the voice of Robert Moses to recite verbatim, as automatically as if the mention had triggered a tape recorder inside his head, the old slogans: "A bridge would have cost half as much as a tunnel, you know, carry twice the amount of traffic, could be built in half the time." What made his defeat all the more bitter was his belief that Eleanor Roosevelt had engineered it. She denied this, writing, in the only other mention ever made in my day of the Battery Crossing, "Needless to say, I have never spoken to anyone in the War Department on this subject. I would like to add that I did not know that Mr. Moses had an interest in this bridge, which shows how dumb I am." But Moses, discussing the crossing controversy years later, would snarl, "Oh, she was in the middle of it, all right. It was her more than anyone else. So now they've got a tunnel, costs twice as much, handles one half of the capacity, took twice as long to build." For years, Mrs. Roosevelt's popularity restrained him from attacking her publicly, although, in private, his descriptions of her were, in Lazarus' words, increasingly unprintable. But in the memoirs he wrote long after Eleanor Roosevelt was dead, he said, as if determined to get his feelings on the record for posterity, "A review of my day discloses an endless succession of noble impulses unsupported by thought or evidence, or naivete and sophistication, modesty and assurance, the product of confused early education, a cloistered girlhood, and sudden precipitation into world affairs. My day spread the dubious gospel that all problems yield to good intentions. Converting a bridge into a tunnel was a trivial incident in such a record." There was one more pill for Moses to swallow, a $12 million pill. The RFC's $59 million was enough to build the tunnel and part of the Manhattan approaches, but none of Brooklyn's. LaGuardia said the city would pay for the rest of the Manhattan approaches. Since it would take 4 years to build the tunnel, the money would not have to be appropriated until 1943, but he made no announcement about any Brooklyn approaches. When Moses went to the mayor, with considerably more humility than was his wont, to inquire about the 5-mile, $12 million elevated highway to Owl's Head Park that had been planned to link the Battery Crossing with his circumferential parkway, the mayor said blandly that the city didn't have the money and that he didn't feel he could ask Washington for it. Perhaps sometime in the future. Without that highway, the Belt System, the great circle bypass around the city of which Moses had been dreaming since 1927, would still have a 5-mile gap. Reluctantly, he told the mayor that Triborough would build the highway if he could charge a 10-cent toll to finance its cost. Blandly, the mayor replied that he didn't think tolls on highways were a good idea. Besides, he went on, hadn't Moses already said, while arguing for Triborough's right to build the bridge, that Triborough had more than $12 million available? Whether or not Roosevelt, working with LaGuardia, both men aware how driven Moses was to realize his dreams, had set the RFC loan at a figure exactly enough for a tunnel and nothing else in order to force Moses to cough up the money for the highway is not known, but that is the way it worked out. The tunnel authority, rather than Moses Triborough authority, was given the right to build the Battery Crossing and the revenues from it. But Triborough was forced to build the road to get to the crossing, obtaining even a soupçon of revenge on Robert Moses, promising to sign a minor bill he wanted and then reneging on the promise, had, Reuben Lazarus said, made Roosevelt, as governor, look as fresh and happy as though he had just come out of the bath after a clean shave in the morning. After the Battery Crossing fight, Roosevelt must have looked as if he had just spent a week at a health resort. On July 20, 1939, the Central Committee of Organizations Opposing the Battery Toll Bridge held a victory luncheon at the Architectural League. The taste of victory must have been sweet, for the luncheon did not end until after 3. Rising votes of thanks were tendered to the heroes of the Goo Goo Uprising from McCanany on down. The reformers laughed when Albert Bard recounted details of an Architectural League luncheon that had been held in the same building on the previous day. Imar Embry had given a speech, and after it, persistent questioning by a member of the audience, finally, as the minutes of the victory luncheon put it, elicited the fact that Mr. Embry regarded as approximately accurate the drawing that Commissioner Moses called completely phony. And when Ole Singstad rose to announce that he had just modified the tunnel plans to remove even the tunnel ventilation shaft from Battery Park, he had found a way to place it north of Battery Place, they cheered in a scene of triumph and jubilation. If the reformers had looked at the Battle of the Battery Crossing in a broader perspective, however, they would have been holding not a victory luncheon, but a wake. For in such a perspective, the significance of the battle in the history of New York City, the key point about the fight and its significance for the city's future was not that the president had stepped in and stopped Robert Moses from building a project that might have irreparably damaged the city. The key point was that it had taken the president to stop him. The city's own mayor, the elected representative of the city's people, the personification of the city's will, hadn't been able to stop him. Neither had the city's other elected officials, or its most wealthy, prestigious, and influential private citizens, the in-group or establishment that could, when united, usually count on carrying the day on any issue about which it was particularly concerned. In the governmental institutions, Board of Estimate and City Council, established to ensure that the voice of the city's people would be heard and obeyed, their voice had been drowned out by his voice. There were other governmental institutions, Planning Commission, Art Commission, set up to ensure that physical changes to the city would be governed by rational, logical planning considerations, and that their specific form would be determined by informed and educated aesthetic taste, not by capricious whim and passing fancy, and certainly not by the whim and fancy and personal taste of a single individual. But rational, logical planning considerations and informed and educated aesthetic taste had crumbled before his will. The explanation for the denouement of the Battle of the Battery Crossing was simply personal pique. The fact that a man who for years had hated Robert Moses had finally been given a chance to give that hatred a little venting. The battle had proven that the powers he had obtained as head of a new part-private, part-public entity, a body corporate and politic, were vast enough so that in his spheres of activity, he, not the formal democratic institutions of New York, would henceforth shape New York's destiny. Chapter 30. Revenge. A man that studieth revenge keeps his own wounds green. Sir Francis Bacon. In victory, Robert Moses had proven himself savage. In defeat, he was to prove himself more savage still. He couldn't hurt Franklin Roosevelt or his wife, but the reformers who had brought Eleanor and Franklin into the Battle of the Battery Crossing and had thus engineered his defeat were vulnerable because they loved the old fort in Battery Park and the aquarium it housed. He set out to tear the fort down, to raze it to the ground, to destroy every trace that it had ever existed. The fort and the aquarium were located in a park, and in a park, thanks to the powers they had helped give him, he was sure that not even a president could prevent him from doing exactly what he wanted. As soon as Moses announced, on February 6, 1941, that the aquarium was obsolete and unsuitable, that its ventilation and lighting were poor, and its roof in need of repair, that the construction of the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel would require its demolition anyway, and that therefore he was going to demolish it immediately and turn over part of the Bronx Zoological Park to the New York Zoological Society, the aquarium's administrator, for a new ultra-modern $2 million aquarium, some reformers who had bumped heads with Moses in the past, notably Bill Exton, suspected that revenge, pure and simple, was one of the primary reasons, if not in fact the only reason, behind the announcement. But most of the older reformers at the Citizens Union and City Club refused at first to believe Exton, until, as they delved into the reasons for the proposed demolition, it became more and more difficult for even the most generous-minded of them to find any reason for it other than the satisfaction of a personal grudge. Moses said the aquarium was obsolete and unsuitable. The 2,500,000 visits to the museum each year, the fact that many of these visits were made by men and women who had been taken to it years before by their own parents and who were now bringing their own children to see its wonders, and the almost universal affection for the dark and musty old building in the hearts of New Yorkers made this a rather difficult argument to accept. But even if it was accepted, the answer need not be demolition. As a letter published in the Herald Tribune inquired, "If the roof leaks, then it can be repaired. If the ventilation is poor, then it can be corrected. But why remove the aquarium entirely?" The cost of such alterations might be expensive, but they certainly would not approach $2 million, even if $2 million was an accurate cost estimate for the new aquarium, and the reformers' friends in the Zoological Society soon let them know that the figure bore little relation to reality. Moses never attempted to answer this inquiry. Moses said that moving the aquarium to the Bronx Zoo would make it attractive to increasing numbers of people. The greatest attraction of the aquarium was its accessibility. In comparison, the Bronx Zoo was rather inaccessible. What, the reformers asked, was Moses talking about? Moses never bothered to reply. When a storm of protest arose not only from the reformers but from the public, there were whole columns of letters to the editor day after day. Editors trying to balance out the selection they printed found it difficult to do so. So scarce were letters favoring Moses' proposal. Moses attempted to give additional reasons, but upon the reformers' examination of these reasons, each turned out to be invalid. Moses stated that tunneling under Battery Park would undermine the aquarium and cause its walls to crumble. Bill Exton checked with the two engineers who were doing the tunneling, Ole Singstad, in charge of the construction of the tunnel proper, and Walter Binger, in charge of the underpass approach from the West Side Highway, and Singstad and Binger just laughed at this argument. No tunneling, no construction work of any type on either the tunnel proper or the underpass approach would come within 170 feet of the aquarium. Then Moses declared that, whether or not there was any tunneling under the old fort, it was going to fall down. His engineers, he said, had discovered that some of its walls were tilted and in imminent danger of collapse, and that a massive reconstruction job, whose cost he put at $200,000, would be necessary to make it safe. This couldn't be true, could it? Asked reformers. The walls of that fort, 8 feet thick and solid sandstone, seemed as sturdy a structure as they had ever seen. Of course it wasn't true, said engineers who weren't on Moses' staff. A joke! I thought it was a joke when he first said that. Binger snorts. How could it fall down? What was it but an open ring of walls 8 feet thick, 600 feet around, and 200 feet in diameter? An annular, open ring with a center that's been standing for 200-300 years. Sick, actually, for 139 years. Isn't going to just fall down. Fall down! Ridiculous! Absurd! And suppose one piece showed signs of falling. You just brace it up. A joke! That's what it was, young man. A joke! Moses had an aesthetic as well as an engineering rationale for his decision. The fort was not beautiful, he said, but an ugly, large red wart. And as for its historic interest, he said flatly that it has no history worth writing about. The only people who wanted to retain the aquarium, he said, were stuffed shirts. After he announced his plans, there was not a dry eye at the Knickerbocker Club. All the shades were drawn at the Century Association, and heart-rending sobs issued from the dusty diggings of the American Scenic and Historic Preservation Society. But somehow the great popular uprising against the raising of this structure hasn't materialized. The proof of the falseness of Moses' statement was on record day after day in the letters to the editor columns. It wasn't only goo-goos who were writing, but men and women who could not possibly be classified as aristocrats, but who wanted Fort Clinton saved because, as one put it, he had visited it so often that it seemed an old friend. Because, as another wrote, without it, Battery Park will be lonesome. Because it was, in a word found in many of the letters, beautiful. Or because it was the place where they, or their parents or grandparents, where millions had first stepped onto the soil of the United States. An elderly woman said that there must be many other Americans who, like her, were reminded every time they went to the old fort of how they had, years before, felt their eyes fill with tears and their hearts fill with thankfulness as they passed through the doorway of Castle Garden, the doorway to liberty, a new life, a new world. All the reasons Moses advanced to justify his decision, engineering, aesthetic, historic, were misleading. Not reasons at all, but rationales, and transparently false rationales at that. And if the reasons Moses advanced were invalid, what then was the true reason? If, as Exton wrote to the Times in one of a series of eloquent letters, the very engineers building the tunnel said that they could build it without disturbing the old fort, why, then, must this ancient and familiar thing be torn from us? More to the point, why did it have to be torn from us now? Perhaps Moses did want to build a more modern aquarium in the Bronx, but the plans were not ready, and the money for construction, as the Zoological Society readily confessed, was nowhere in sight. As a matter of fact, although the reformers did not know this, Moses was not even certain where he wanted the new aquarium to be located. He had simply thrown out the Bronx Zoo as the most likely location he could think of without study. Even if the reformers accepted the argument that there was not room in a city of 7 million for two aquariums, why was it necessary to demolish the existing aquarium years before the new one could possibly be ready, thereby leaving the city for years without any aquarium at all? What was going to happen to the aquarium's matchless collection of sea life, amassed over decades at fabulous cost and effort and ingenuity? What was the reason for Moses' insistence that this ancient and familiar thing not only be destroyed, but be destroyed immediately? If the aquarium was torn down, moreover, why did the fort beneath it also have to be torn down? Reluctant as the old goo-goos had been to believe Exton's charges that Moses was motivated by nothing but a mean desire for revenge, many of them eventually concluded that the young man must be right. Years later, the few still alive would be asked about Moses' motivation. "If you knew Bob Moses, you wouldn't have to ask that," Paul Windels would say. "Bob Moses could hate. If you stood up to him, he would hate you forever. If you defeated him, he would try to destroy you. Here were guys he couldn't destroy, so he decided to do the next best thing, destroy something they loved." George McCainany would point out that Moses claimed that tearing down the aquarium and fort had been made necessary because of the tunnel which they themselves had advocated was a particularly apt means of revenge. To destroy the aquarium and fort on the spur of a base impulse would be a crime against the city, against history, the reformers felt. They determined to prevent it. But they couldn't. Moses' possession of unlimited powers over park administrative decisions made it possible for him simply to announce an administrative decision on Battery Park and the aquarium. For the safety of the public, they would be closed as soon as intensive tunnel work began on October 1, 1941, the park for the duration of such work, the aquarium forever. The reformers would have had no opportunity to protest Moses' plans to demolish the aquarium and the old fort to any official body if the park commissioner hadn't needed money, a $20,000 appropriation from the Board of Estimate for tanks to house the fish in their new home in the Bronx. The Zoological Society, which Moses had claimed had resources of $2 million, proved unable to raise $20,000. His need for a board appropriation meant that there would have to be a public hearing and, in theory, a board decision. But in reality, what choice did the board have? The park around the aquarium was going to be closed shortly, fenced off from the public. Disapproving the appropriation wouldn't keep the aquarium open. It would only keep Moses from moving the fish to the Bronx Zoo, which would mean either that the fish would stay in the aquarium for years with the public unable to see them, or that Moses would carry out a threat to dump the fish into the sea. When the reformers attempted to raise the demolition question, Moses replied blandly that that wasn't the issue at all. He wasn't asking for approval of the demolition of the structure, he said, but only for moving the fish out of it. He himself had no objection to keeping the fort if the board wanted to provide for its rehabilitation, he said, and anyway, the board would have a chance to decide the demolition question at some other date, after the completion of a study by consultant Gilmore Clark, which he had commissioned. The choices open to the board and the mayor were further limited by Moses' popularity. In less than 2 months, the politicians' futures would be in the hands of the voters, and Moses' personal popularity with the voters was far too great to be appreciably damaged by an unpopular stand on a single issue, particularly since the city's press, as if to atone for its heresy in opposing him in the crossing and aquarium fights, was laying on the personal adulation in even heavier doses than usual. It was during this pre-election period that the Times commented, on the occasion of the opening of the Gowanus Parkway, "When Commissioner Moses finds the surface of the earth too congested with his parkways, he lifts the road into the air." No politician wanted to make himself the target of the commissioner's public wrath. Joseph A. Palma, up for re-election as borough president of Richmond County, had stated in May that the aquarium should not be torn down. "It's a landmark," he had said forthrightly. "We've been destroying too many of our landmarks recently." In September, Palma said not a word, but voted for Moses' proposal. Newbold Morris, up for re-election as council president, had stated in May that, "If $2 million has to be spent, I favor putting it into a tuberculosis hospital in Brooklyn." In September, Morris did not mention any tuberculosis hospital, and he voted for Moses' proposal. As for Fiorello H. LaGuardia, who had supposedly mastered the city, he could have swayed Morris and the others if he had wanted to, and for a while he apparently wanted to. The mayor agreed that the aquarium's accessibility was a great civic asset, and friends saw that he had more than a little affection for the old building himself. In May, he and Moses had both been speakers at the opening of a new waterhole at the Bronx Zoo. Moses had cockily predicted that the Zoological Society could schedule a fish chowder at the aquarium on October 1st, for the valuable specimens would be up at the zoo by that time. But LaGuardia had stunned Moses by stating flatly, "He won't bring the fish to the Bronx." Whether political considerations were influencing the mayor's thinking on the aquarium in September is unknown, but the following sequence of events occurred. The right-wingers who dominated the Bronx and Queens Republican organizations, along with some key Republicans in other boroughs, also determined to deny the mayor a third term, offered Moses the nomination. Moses didn't want the nomination. He knew it was worthless without Fusion backing, which only LaGuardia could obtain, and his understanding of the power of his public authorities made him uninterested in elective office. But he did not turn down the GOP nod out of hand, telling the leaders he was taking it under consideration. LaGuardia felt he could not win without the nomination. Moses turned the nomination down. The old line leaders then nominated John R. Davies, who would run against LaGuardia in the primary election September 16th. When the Moses proposal came before the board, the mayor's three votes were cast for it. 4 days later, Moses announced his support of LaGuardia, who won the primary by only 20,000, and a whole wave of park openings, at each of which Moses took pains to praise LaGuardia, was then scheduled before the election, in which the mayor narrowly defeated Democratic candidate William O'Dwyer. There is no clearer proof of Moses' aura of invincibility than O'Dwyer's reaction to his loud support of the mayor. Far from attacking the park commissioner, O'Dwyer assured the voters that he would continue him in office if he were elected. By October 1st, after a September in which parents by the tens of thousands had brought their children to the aquarium one last time, Moses could tell the Board of Estimate, "The fish are gone. The aquarium, therefore, as such, is a tale that has been told. We don't have to talk about that anymore. The only question is Fort Clinton." And, he said, consultant Clark had found that demolition of the old fort was necessary for the complete reconstruction of Battery Park that he had in mind. The board approved the demolition by an 11-5 vote. As in the bridge tunnel controversy, no force in the city had been powerful enough to stand between Moses and his aims. There would, within a matter of months, have been, except for a plaque, no trace of the old fort, had it not been for another force outside the city and beyond Moses' control, the Second World War. To Moses' rage, the war stripped the city of manpower and heavy construction equipment so completely that no demolition company would bid on the job of leveling those massive solid stone walls. He let a smaller contract for the less difficult demolition of the circular sheet iron roof that covered the fort, and by the fall of 1942, the roof was gone, and the interior of the fort, as well as the ground in front of it, was littered with debris. He was attempting again to get the rest of the job finished when the war gave the reformers another opportunity by halting work on the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel. The reformers, realizing that neither the executive nor the legislative branch of the city government could stop Moses, made a last desperate try to persuade the judicial branch to do the job, bringing suit to enjoin him from demolishing the rest of the building on the grounds that he had induced the board to grant him permission through false and fraudulent representation, namely that the demolition was required by work on the tunnel. The judiciary could not restrain Moses. The reformers pressed the appeal to the Court of Appeals, but each court found, in effect, that Moses had virtually absolute power in city parks. But the last appeal was not heard until April 1943, and by that time, the equipment and manpower shortage had reached a stage where even Moses realized it was useless to attempt any further demolition until the war was over. It would be more than 5 years before work on the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel was resumed. There was no reason why Battery Park should have been closed during those years, but closed it was. The gates in the high wooden fences that Moses had erected around it, fences too high for passers-by to see over, remained locked. The city's press had assumed that the fight over the old fort was ended, had been over, in fact, from the moment Moses had made his decision about it. Commenting on one of his fierce attacks on the reformers, the Herald Tribune had said, "With the unleashing of that dread artillery, it is clear that Castle Clinton, along with the traditionalists, are done for." But the writer of that editorial must have been a young man. He must never have seen the traditionalists, in particular George McCanany, fighting for something they believed in. The old fort had become even dearer to the old man since Moses had proposed tearing it down. Shortly before his death in 1953, at the age of 84, McEnany was invited to contribute a memoir to the oral history research collection at Columbia.